ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. I want to welcome on behalf of the court McGuanago's high school students. Would they stand? Welcome. You may be seated, please. The students are here with us this morning on the Court with Class program, which is a program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. It's a national prize-winning program, and the students have been given materials about this case, and they have had extra work on the case, and part of that program is at noon they meet with a justice of this court, and everyone is welcome to also meet with that justice, and the discussion will be about the procedures the court uses in hearing and deciding cases. We expect later. They're here. Okay. I'm told Lakeshore Technical College paralegal students are here. Would they stand? And welcome to you all, too. You may be seated. So all of you are welcome to attend at noon at our session, and I would like to now introduce the court to all of you. I'll start on my far left, Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox, and the group will meet with Justice Wilcox at noon. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice William Babbage, and to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right, Justice David Prosser. With those preliminaries taken care of, I'll call the first case for this morning, 01-1345-CR, State v. Paul Stewart. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Stewart is Attorney Christopher William Rose, who will argue for not more than 25 minutes and has 5 minutes in rebuttal, and then the Assistant Attorney General will argue on behalf of the state. Mr. Rose.
Thank you. May it please the court, Chief Justice Abramson. It's a pleasure to be here. It's my first time being here. First
it's
of all,
especially tough on first timers.
Oh, really? Okay. First of all, the first issue and the reason for the certification of this case has to do with the preliminary hearing testimony of Paul Stewart, Paul Stewart's brother, John. And first of all, it's the defendant appellant Paul Stewart's position that the preliminary hearing testimony should have been admitted. The trial court admitted the testimony. The Court of Appeals on appeal agreed with the trial court's decision that the preliminary hearing testimony should not have been admitted. And then again, this the case came before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, which reversed. First of all, it's our position that that order of the Supreme Court does not establish the law of the case for purposes of this appeal. The reason for our opinion is threefold. One, it's not a published decision, obviously. Secondly, there wasn't any legal reasoning cited in the order. The third is that there were not any legal authorities cited in the order. And the fourth thing that we believe supports our position is the case of State versus Wirtz. First of all, whenever we are dealing with the Confrontation Clause, there's the two-part analysis that the court has to go through, trial court, appellate court, or Supreme Court. First of all, whether or not the Confrontation Clause has been satisfied pursuant to the rules of evidence, In this case, whether or not the there's a hearsay exception which applies. And first of all, the Mr. John Stewart, Paul Stewart's brother, had testified at the preliminary hearing that, first of all, Paul had killed Gary Regals, that he asked John to provide a false alibi, and that he had fixed the crime scene to look like a suicide. At trial, as we know, Paul Stewart's brother John pled the Fifth Amendment and refused to testify. In spite of this, the court felt that even though he pled the Fifth Amendment, that the Confrontation Clause in this instance was not satisfied because of the fact that there was an insufficient opportunity to cross-examine John at the preliminary hearing. Again, this was a murder trial, lasted a number of weeks. The preliminary hearing was approximately 30 pages, and I believe the cross-examination wasn't very lengthy. But more importantly,
let me ask you, since you're giving us the facts, your Mr. Stewart, John Stewart, was also granted immunity, wasn't he, by the court?
He was, but he still refused to testify and still pled the Fifth Amendment. He continued to plead the Fifth Amendment and refused to testify throughout the entire trial.
Are you arguing he's not unavailable? Are you arguing that he is available, or is your argument that he is unavailable but it's not reliable anyway?
Well, he's clearly unavailable because he refused to testify. That really isn't the issue. The issue here is whether or not the Confrontation Clause was satisfied. Clearly, it's our opinion that it was not. There was an objection made at the preliminary hearing regarding the circumstances surrounding the statement that John Stewart gave to the detectives at the time that at the time of the preliminary hearing, and so the defense attorney was not allowed to go into any of the circumstances surrounding the statement, which I think is important not only for purposes of the preliminary hearing, but it's also important for purposes of the entire trial, because the jury never was allowed the opportunity to hear any evidence surrounding the circumstances behind his statement, which we've also outlined and in our brief. First of all, it's also our opinion that the circumstances surrounding John Stewart's statement should have been admitted at the trial, and that his trial counsel should have brought forth evidence of that, at least to the trial court, and if the trial court obviously would have admitted it to the jury. First of all, the state had granted John Stewart immunity for his testimony, was going to grant him immunity for his testimony in return for his statement that he gave to the police in April. Secondly, that the Illinois state's attorney also granted John Stewart immunity for his was going to grant him immunity for his testimony in that he had committed a burglary in Illinois, and in return the Illinois state's attorney agreed that they would not prosecute John Stewart for that crime as long as he gave a truthful statement to
Mr.
the police.
Mr. Rose, let me, if I might interrupt for
sure.
A minute. Your arguments that you're getting into now about the lack of satisfaction of the Confrontation Clause, that really isn't relevant if, indeed, the decision made by this Court 3-plus years ago was the rule of the case, the rule of law in regard to the case. Isn't that correct?
That would be correct, but it's our position that, in fact, it did not establish the law of the case. And the reason for that is...
Let me just stop you, because
Sure. Earlier
you told us that it was not the law of the case, and among other things you said there was no legal reasoning and no legal authority. How do you get around the case of Christensen versus Colt Industries, a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that indicates that where you have a court's decision based upon a rule of law, that is the law of the case, regardless of whether or not there's any legal reasoning set forth, whether or not there's any legal authorities relied upon, it becomes the rule of the law of the case. How do you get around that case?
Well,
I mean, it seems to be totally contrary to the position you're taking.
Well, first of all, I don't agree that the order of the court was at all sufficient to determine whether or not or how the court's decision was rendered. I understand your statement that there was reasoning in the opinion. However, the reasoning that, from our perspective, that I read was simply that we've considered the argument of the trial court and the court of appeals, and it's now reversed.
Well, let's look at what was occurring. This was a trial that was stayed for this court to consider what the court of appeals had decided on an interlocutory basis. We had oral arguments. We made a decision. And then we lifted the stay so the trial could resume. So there was some reason to move expeditiously, was there not?
Well, I agree there was a reason to move expeditiously, but even the Court of Appeals, in its decision, cited to case law and gave legal reasoning and a legal opinion. So although I agree that there was an interlocutory order and that there was a need for some speed here, I don't think that that translates into, well, the order, as it stated, that the decision is reversed. I don't believe it means that we can't expect there to be some.
Do you think if we had cited the Bauer case or the Tomlinson case hadn't been decided yet, but if we had cited the Bauer case, would that have satisfied your objections, just a citation to a case?
Well, a citation to a case along with legal reasoning, as far as law of the case goes, may have satisfied, you know, I'm simply speculating, the fact that that would no longer be an issue. However, it would still be our opinion, and still is our opinion, that the preliminary hearing testimony of John should never have been admitted.
Why are you taking that tack? You put the court in a position, which it often is in, of saying, we goofed. But, you know, that's a tough road for a lawyer. You know, lawyers prefer to take easier roads, and the court prefers an easier road, right, than admitting error. And it strikes me that why don't you take the tack that the rule of law is not an absolute, or the rule of the case is not an absolute, that even if the court had given you reasons and set forth authorities, things happen at trial that change. And so the law of the case is a discretionary rule, as I understand it, with this court on further review.
Correct.
And so that's why I think that when you launch into this concept of did this preliminary hearing satisfy confrontation, you're just going back to the merits of that first trial court decision, the first court of appeals decision, and saying to this court, it had merit, and you want to argue it, and in the discretion of this court, it can consider that and rule on it again the same way it ruled before or in another way, because the law of the case is a discretionary rule as far as I understand it and not absolute. Now, if I'm wrong as to the status of the law of the case.
No, I believe that's correct. And in fact, I don't believe that at the time that this case was argued before this court that it had a full overview of the trial or all of the issues, because again, one of the most important issues here that was never raised at trial and was in fact only raised at post-conviction by his appellate attorney was what were those circumstances? What were the circumstances surrounding the statement? And none of that, I don't believe, was, I'm sorry.
Let me just double back. Do you accept as a general proposition that when a witness is unavailable, that testimony at preliminary hearing is usable. That's Bauer, I think. Do you accept that? As a general proposition, with circumstances can change that.
Well, that's only the first part of the step, I think. I mean, if he's unavailable in the preliminary hearing, he's testified. I mean, there also has to be a sufficient opportunity to cross-examine the witness.
Okay. Had there been full cross-examination, then you would accept that this preliminary hearing could be used, right?
No, it would depend upon what the questions were that were asked.
Okay, this is not a trap, counsel. I'll put it affirmatively. I think your position is that where the defendant cannot cross-examine relating to reliability or truthfulness of the witness, because the issue is not credibility but plausibility, then you got a problem putting in the preliminary hearing. Is that a summary of your position?
Yes, I would say that is a correct statement.
All right. So if you don't have a credibility issue and get full examination, at least you start off with a lot of cases saying this is okay evidence, all right? So now you've got a lot of cases that saying you can't question on credibility because this is a plausibility issue, right?
Correct.
So is it your position then that the problem with this witness is that he was, you could attack his credibility if you understood the context?
Yes, I'd say that is our position, that if you understood the entire context, that his credibility could have been attacked and could have been attacked at trial, which that was never allowed, and it was never allowed at the preliminary hearing. And I think it's pretty important, particularly when you look at the circumstances surrounding the statement that he gave to the detectives, that he was charged with a number of crimes, and that right before he gave a statement to the detectives, in fact, right before he testified, I believe it was a day before, the state filed an amended information against him, reducing his potential imprisonment from 50 years to 12.
That information was all independently available, apart from the unavailable witness, was it not? So the fact that it was not included in the preliminary hearing transcript is irrelevant.
I don't agree that the fact that it wasn't that it was irrelevant. I believe that it is completely relevant.
Well, answer my first question.
Okay,
first.
Sure.
And that was that all the information that you've just alluded to,
uh-huh,
which you say was not permitted in the preliminary hearing, the circumstances surrounding the making of the statement.
Right.
Was independently available. And I know it's part of your ineffective assistance of counsel claim that defense counsel at trial didn't get into that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was independently available. So the fact that there was no cross-examination on those subjects during the preliminary hearing is irrelevant to the admissibility of that transcript under the statute, 908.045.
Well, again, I don't believe that it makes it irrelevant just because it was independently available.
Why not? If he can get it in through some other source, what difference does the unavailability of the witness make? He could put all of those facts before the jury.
Well, I agree.
You could, means.
I agree you could put those facts before the jury, but they never were put before the jury.
Right, but that's part of your ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Correct.
That, you know, for purposes of the Confrontation Clause analysis, that issue does not create the sort of unusual circumstances that Bauer and the case law require to say that there's a Confrontation Clause violation here. Because it's not unusual.
It's not unusual that the fact that the trial attorney at the preliminary hearing was not able to get into any of the circumstances surrounding the statement he made to detectives to test his credibility?
If that information is independently available as evidence and can be placed before the jury through another witness, then we don't have the kind of unusual circumstances that would require exclusion of the prior testimony on Confrontation Clause grounds.
If all the information that was surrounding his statement was given to the jury...
No, not whether it was or wasn't. It was available. The fact that defense counsel may have neglected to put it before the jury is a separate question on ineffective assistance of counsel. But on the Confrontation Clause issue, it was available. It could have been placed before the jury. So the circumstances surrounding the making of the statement that was testified to in the prelim, that evidence was independently available. So there aren't the sort of unusual circumstances that would require the exclusion of that transcript on Confrontation Clause grounds.
Again, I respectfully disagree with that statement.
Why?
Well, first of all, again, there wasn't any evidence presented or any opportunity to even ask John Stewart at the preliminary hearing, were you granted immunity for your testimony? Were you granted immunity by the state of Wisconsin, by the state's attorney, anything?
But there were cops available to testify to that.
Police officers?
Right. I mean, the defendant, through
I suppose there were detectives
the police
who could have.
Officers to the stand to testify, did you give John Norman immunity to make this statement?
Well, I suppose there were prosecutors and or detectives who could have testified to that information.
Fully available to your client, had his counsel chosen to call them.
At the preliminary hearing?
No, at the trial.
At the trial? Yes, I agree, but he didn't. He didn't do that.
Right. That goes to ineffective assistance of counsel. But on the Confrontation Clause issue, there are no unusual circumstances because that independent evidence was available fully.
Well, then you could say, I don't agree. I mean, I guess I don't really understand the position because, if in fact, even if that information was available and it wasn't presented, why isn't that an unusual circumstance? If you're not allowed to even ask one simple question surrounding to test the witness's credibility. So I guess I just don't agree with that statement. Even if it is information that's readily available, as I understand what your statement is that's not an unusual circumstance because it wasn't presented. Is that my understanding of what your question is?
I mean, don't.
I think we've taken this as far as.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's clear that the information was available to counsel to use, counsel for your client, had he chose to do so. That's all.
Correct. If he had chosen to do so, I agree. It was available to him. But he didn't, and therefore, again, I believe that goes into the ineffective assistance claim, which he should have gone into at trial and presented that evidence to the jury, but it never was.
I'd like to go
back
to...
And that's what your position is on pages 27 to 30 of your brief, namely that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to offer evidence of the circumstances.
Right.
So you've got a twofold attack.
Correct.
At the initial position before trial,
mm-hmm.
the fact that there was no opportunity to cross-examine and impeach credibility, you say, therefore, the trial judge should have suppressed that evidence. That's
correct.
Your position. And that this court erred in not doing that. Once you got to trial, then your position is... Seems to me the position still is there was an error in the first place, but that trial counsel did not make up that error. I mean, it would have been probably much more effective with the jury had he been able to impeach this witness himself. So you go to second best, which is get detectives or anyone else you can, and the counsel didn't do it, and you view that as prejudicial error.
Exactly.
Harmless, that it was prejudicial error for ineffective assistance of counsel.
Correct.
Do that. Why was it prejudicial in this case?
Well, it was extremely prejudicial in this case because even in closing, the prosecutor, the state said that the most important testimony of all in this case came through John Stewart and Art Paramore. And that, I think, is why it's so significant that the jury needed to hear the circumstances surrounding the statement that he gave to detectives, which was never presented or offered to the jury. I think when the state makes such a sweeping conclusion, say, look, this is the most important testimony of all in this entire trial, that we can't say that that is not prejudicial, nor can we say that that isn't harmless. I believe that's completely harmful to the defense, especially when, again, there's no opportunity to cross-examine John Stewart at the preliminary hearing, nor has there been any offer of any evidence at the trial by his trial attorney. So given John Stewart's statement, the fact no circumstances were allowed to be heard by the jury surrounding that statement, and given the prosecutor's closing argument that that was one of the most important testimony, that and Mr. Paramore, I believe, establishes that this was prejudicial and that it was not harmless error. And further, that goes into the statement or some of the statements that were given by Art Paramore at trial also, wherein, again, the state conceded in its closing argument that, again, Art Paramore's testimony was, along with John Stewart's, the most important of all. Art Paramore, right immediately after the murder occurred, he and Paul Stewart left for Arizona. They were traveling in a vehicle, and this is when Paul Stewart told Art Paramore that he had killed Gary Riegels. Now, later he said that, well, I was just trying to intimidate him or because of something to do with a relative of his, but again, at closing, the state conceded that both Art Paramore's testimony and John Stewart's were the most important, which goes into the other claim, the other ineffective assistance claim.
Before you do that, counsel, I'd like to go back to the questions that this case was certified to this court on. This is Justice Crooks' line of questioning, because unless you get past those, you're not getting any further here. So we have to focus back on that. And that is the question of the law of the case doctrine.
Sure.
And you're relying most heavily, in fact, I think pretty exclusively, on the Wirtz case, which said that the law of the case doctrine does not necessarily bind a trial court when the appellate court affirms a prior discretionary ruling of the trial court and the case goes back to trial, that the subsequent trial court can come to a different discretionary ruling, even though the prior discretionary ruling had been affirmed by the appellate court, that doesn't necessarily establish law of the case binding on the lower court, and that case applies here. In this case, we have an appellate court reversal of a discretionary ruling of a trial court and a remand with instructions consistent with that reversal. In other words, admit the evidence. Isn't that a very significant distinction?
Well, I agree it's a distinction. However, I don't necessarily agree it's a significant distinction. It's still admission or non-admission of the preliminary hearing testimony, still a discretionary decision of the trial court.
You think that the trial judge in this case was free to disregard this court's order to admit the evidence under law of the case doctrine and under Wirtz?
Pursuant to the Wirtz case, which is the only cited case that in this state regarding that issue, I would say that's a correct statement. And no matter how I understand that the court feels about that
issue. It has nothing to do with feelings. It has to do with the law.
Right.
You think that the trial judge in this case, the trial having been halted for interlocutory appellate litigation on the admissibility of this evidence, you think the trial judge, after this court said admit the evidence, was free under the Wirtz case to say no? I'm going to make a different discretionary judgment call and stick with my original ruling.
Only because of the fact that, again, there wasn't anything in the opinion which guided the trial court to determine exactly what the court's opinion was stating. And one of the things that I raised in my brief originally to the Court of Appeals was simply, we don't know what this decision means. I mean, you're reversing the appellate court, which said the preliminary hearing testimony is admissible. But was the court saying, well, yes, this is the preliminary hearing testimony is admissible. Why is it admissible? Or was it saying, well, this case isn't really ripe for a decision at this point, or should we even be at this point of deciding this issue because the trial isn't even concluded? That was the confusion. That was at least my confusion.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Castle, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I am Assistant Attorney General Jeffrey Castle, appearing today on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. For many members of this Court, this case may well bring to mind Yogi Berra's memorable adage, "It's like deja vu all over again." For this is not the first time that this case has been before the Court. 4 years ago, the Court heard oral argument in this case regarding whether the admission of an unavailable witness's preliminary hearing testimony violated the defendant's right to confrontation. 4 years ago, this Court reversed the Court of Appeals decision, which had held that it did. What has changed in the 4 years since this Court last heard this case? Not the legal issue, whether the use of John Stort's preliminary hearing testimony violated the defendant's right to confrontation, for that is the same issue that was before the Court 4 years ago. Not the applicable legal principles or governing case law, as the principles announced in such cases as Ohio v. Roberts and State v. Bauer continue to provide the legal framework for analyzing that issue.
Counsel, during the course of that hearing or in preparation for that hearing, My memory is very fogged as to what went on, but I assume that briefs were submitted.
Correct.
Did you argue it?
No, that was before I joined the department. Was
but have you read those briefs in preparation for today?
I have.
Upon what basis did the state urge us to reverse the Court of Appeals?
Purely on confrontation clause grounds.
Was there any suggestion in the court's brief or in the state's brief that one solution was to reverse and then later rule on the merits, but to simply allow it in?
I don't believe there was in the brief. That question came up during oral argument, though. I listened to the oral argument. And there was some concern in the context of, well, if the state has a right to appeal these, aren't we going to have too many interlocutories appeals by the state from rulings excluding evidence. So in the context of that, the Assistant Attorney General suggested that perhaps there could be a presumption that when there's a close call, let the evidence in rather than exclude the state's evidence and then review it in the context of a completed trial if there were a conviction. But that was in the context of addressing the concerns of would there be too many interlocutory appeals. But that was not urged as a grounds for reversing the Court of Appeals decision in this case at any point, is my recollection.
Could it have been the basis for our decision?
I don't think that would be a proper basis.
Could it have been the basis for our decision? Do you know what the basis of our decision was?
I cannot tell from the order, but I think implicit in the order is a ruling on the merits. But I was not in conference.
Where is it implicit in the order?
I think it's implicit because the only grounds for reversal urged were on the merits. And the Court reversed.
Let's just double back for a moment. I assume it's the state's position that this court does not ever have to give a reasoning or list authorities.
The court, that's correct. The court does, there's no rule or statute.
The Court of Appeals does by statute. Maybe that statute's not constitutional and a violation of separation of powers, but at least that's the statute.
Correct.
The Court of Appeals has to give reasons. We don't,
correct.
Right? Because we're the Supreme Court and we can say whatever we want to say.
Exactly.
Yes, okay. So we got that out of the way, all right? Now, let's talk about the law of the case. It's not a firm, fast, hard rule.
Correct.
Right?
That's correct.
Court can decide it made a mistake in a prior ruling in a case, and when the whole case comes back up here, we can re-examine an issue that we previously decided.
With qualifications, yes.
Okay, what are the qualifications?
Well, two qualifications. First, the law of the case certification came up from the Court of Appeals in terms of whether it was bound, and I think under our hierarchical court system, clearly the lower courts are bound. Then the question is this court bound? And you're correct, it is not an absolute doctrine.
Okay.
But the court has said that there need to be cogent reasons, such as a change in facts, change in the law. I don't think reconsideration and a conclusion, well, maybe we got it wrong the last time, is
that's
viewed.
A cogent reason.
No, I think courts will say, I don't know that.
That we made an error of law is not a cogent reason. I mean, if we decided that the first case, first statement of ours, was wrong because we misunderstood the facts or additional facts came in or, okay, you agree that's a cogent reason?
Okay.
If we say that we erred in analyzing the law or we had cases subsequent to that where we decided otherwise, well, the U.S. Supreme Court decided otherwise, even though it may not bind us. You'd agree that was a cogent, those were cogent reasons.
Correct.
Okay. So we're in a discretionary area anyway, okay?
Correct.
Why should we use our discretion or not use our discretion to overrule our prior ruling?
Because, well, part of the purpose of the law of the case is to promote judicial economy and certainty, to avoid, in the absence of any external change circumstances, such as new facts, a new decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, for this court to sit down and say, okay, we've got the same facts, we've got the same law, we've got one new member of the court, do we now agree with the same, with our result from 4 years
but
ago?
Well, and I think Justice Abramson's indicating we could either say, no, we erred, or, look, this is the reason we made the decision, because we had Bauer, we have Christensen, and we have the subsequent case Tomlinson, and therefore this is the way we think it ought to be. I mean, we can, either way.
Either way. Right. The court could frame it from the state's point of view, the state, now that everybody has put the effort in, certainly the state wouldn't mind if we got a ruling from the court that said, we got it right last time, and let us explain why under Bauer, why under Ohio v. Roberts, why under Tomlinson, it's the right result.
Seems to me in essence, we have to do that, or at least it's arguable that we have to do that, because the law of the case is not an absolute doctrine. Therefore.
But I think if the law of the case doctrine is to have any meaning when a case comes back before the same level of the judicial system, there has to be something more than say, please take another look at it. We think you got it wrong.
There has to be a presumption that you're going to follow through. Otherwise, the whole thing's a waste of time.
Correct. And that's why I'm saying in the absence of mere reconsideration.
Let me give you a cogent reason. It seems to me this is the heart of the case, but maybe it's not. Namely, you have a preliminary hearing. You do not get full opportunity to cross-examine. right?
Correct.
And on one issue you can't cross-examine, and that is credibility, right?
Correct.
That's the issue here, right? Credibility.
Yes, that's, I understand the defendant's okay. position.
So, in the abstract, you can frame this as, do you allow preliminary hearing to be used when the witness is unavailable, and we all agree he was unavailable, do you allow the preliminary hearing to be used when the trial court did not allow evidence, did not allow cross-examination on credibility? And ruled, therefore, that you can't use this preliminary. So the question is, in the abstract, is a preliminary hearing allowed to be used when there's no credibility cross-examination and credibility is the issue?
And I think the answer is yes, because...
Well, before you get to the because, isn't that the same question on the merits that was before the court 4 years ago?
Yes. That's the exact question.
So, absent a reason to reopen that,
I don't think
why would we get to the because?
Because Chief Justice answered the question.
Now, I'm not going to go through whether or not this court reversed on the basis of the facts were misstated by the trial court, or the law was misstated by the trial court, or the reasoning wasn't well done, which would have all three been grounds for reversal. Let's forget that. Let's get right to the heart of the basic underlying legal issues, I think. But if you think that's not the legal issue, ignore me. At your peril.
I shall not ignore you. So I'll do my because, even though it is certainly the state's position that we don't have to get to the because.
I will also require an answer to my question, though.
Yes.
So after you answer the chief's, you can answer mine.
I will, and then I'll probably ask you to restate it.
Okay.
So to refresh my memory. I think it is... inherent in cases such as Ohio v. Roberts or Bauer, that there is the recognition that preliminary examinations do differ from trial because there is that restriction on cross-examination going to credibility issue. So the fact that there was a preliminary hearing conducted pursuant to those standard procedures and there was no credibility examination cannot be an unusual circumstance. It is the usual circumstance at a preliminary hearing. Now, if you'll refresh my memory.
So even if the credibility is the issue, it doesn't matter. You have an absolute flat rule.
That's right.
Flat, okay. Even if at trial they're unable to produce other evidence attacking credibility.
That's correct. I don't think we look to see what happened at trial to see. We're looking at the reliability of the preliminary hearing examination, and it is a firmly established hearsay exception from which we infer reliability.
Okay.
Why should the merits of the underlying legal question provide a basis for overriding the law of the case doctrine when there has been no change in the law?
I don't believe it does, and if I suggested that in my answer to the Chief, I misspoke, because I don't think it does. Absent...
Right, so we don't get to a discussion of the merits of the underlying legal question unless there is some principled basis to override the law of the case doctrine. And the law is that, you know, that only comes about when there has been a significant sea change in the law, which has not occurred in this area.
Correct, or unless... for some reason, there was some misapprehension of the facts in the previous time.
Mr. Castle, maybe my confusion rests in just exactly what is meant by the term or the phrase law of the case. Let me see if I can flesh this out. Let's assume that instead of the opinion 4 years ago, or the order from this court that did not state any reasons, let's assume that we had an opinion from the majority. And the opinion said that without ruling on the merits, we believe the better practice is to allow this testimony in, not allow the interlocutory orders because of the delay and confusion that may cause, and have all of these questions heard on the final appeal. And, you know, then goes on and on. What's the law of that case?
In that case, there would be no law of the case other than a determination that, well, it would be an odd rule to apply to this case, because if the court is saying there should not be interlocutory orders, but in fact it is up on an interlocutory order appeal.
I've given you the facts as I want them to, as I'd like you to address. We said that the better practice, which we will follow here, is to not allow interlocutory orders on questions of evidence, except in extremely rare circumstances.
Right. But
what's the law of that case?
The law of the case is that then that the state was not allowed to take its interlocutory appeal, and then the trial court's exclusion would have stood.
Okay, then could the defense have come back and now and said, hey, the law of the case is that, well, no.
Then the law of the case would have been this. The law of the case is the state would probably be out of luck.
Now, what if we had just the opposite? Now, what if we had affirmed without any reasons, so that this couldn't go in, and then the state comes back and appeals, or cross appeals on an appeal, and says that was error. They should have allowed Stewart's question thing in. Could the defense have asserted exactly what you're asserting here, that the law of the case is that this can't go in?
Then there would have been a problem, because the defense was arguing an alternate ground for affirmance, which was that the state shouldn't have been allowed to appeal in the first place. So I'm arguing that that's the law of the case, because I can see only one plausible ground for reversal. Whereas there were alternate, there was a procedural ground urged for affirmance.
You understand, there are seven of us up here. And I could have written long and hard and said the majority should have stated its reasons. I didn't, so I'm equally at fault, if in fact that's the problem. But it seems that in retrospect now that it's clear that we have a problem unless we state a reason, because then the law of the case is unclear. Because this testimony could have been excluded, or we could have done what we did for any number of reasons, some of which might establish a precedent, but some of which might not. I mean, if we had said clearly that this goes in because preliminary examination when the witness isn't present always goes in, I have no problem. That's the law of the case. But we don't know that's the reason that this court acted that way.
And I'm drawing the inference from the way the argument was framed in the court by the parties, by the way the Court of Appeals decided the case, that the only basis for a reversal would have been on the merits, because if the court's reasoning was that there should be no interlocutory appeals, that would not be a basis for reversing the order that was being appealed. That would be a basis, an alternate basis for affirming.
No, the Court of Appeals threw it out.
No,
the Court of Appeals said it couldn't be admitted, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
Well, then, I don't understand what you're saying. What's that?
So the trial court had as well.
The trial court did as well.
Right.
So if we reversed it without reason, we could well have been reversed. I can't understand why there isn't an equally strong inference that we were reversing it because we don't like interlocutory appeals.
But if you don't like interlocutory appeals, you were saying the state should not have been allowed to appeal. No, because it was the state's appeal from an order keeping it out.
No. I think that both of you can draw those inferences, and that's maybe the problem here, and you want to draw that particular inference because that supports you, and that raises the other issue. But let me just ask you this. What case do we have that explicitly states that when credibility is an issue and there wasn't full opportunity in the preliminary to question about credibility, that that is not a confrontation violation? Precisely on that point, which is precisely the issue that came here, which may very well be why this Court took that interlocutory appeal, right? So what case supports that?
Well, Bauer is the case that supports it most strongly, and Tomlinson. But I will acknowledge that I don't think in either of those cases was there an attempt to ask a question that went to credibility. But I don't think we can judge it on the basis of whether defense counsel attempted to ask a question that he or she knew would draw an objection. I mean, let's imagine this case where trial counsel had not asked this question, knowing or anticipating that it would draw this objection. Would we say that's not an unusual circumstance, but it is because counsel drew the objection? I don't think so.
What's the basic reason why you let in a preliminary? You let in this hearsay at trial. What is the basic reason? Because it's reliable.
Because that's right. It has adequate indicia of reliability because it's a firmly established hearsay exception.
Okay. So then the question is, does the fact that you could not attack the witness's credibility undercut the reliability? Because if that's the basis, then if you undercut it, it's gone, right? I mean, that's theoretically.
Theoretical. But I think no, because that is the case in any preliminary hearing. And there are other indicia of reliability. There are the fact that it is under oath in a judicial proceeding, an adversary judicial proceeding. And, in fact, there were numerous questions that, under the rubric of plausibility, allowed defense counsel to test credibility and elicited some pretty harmful information, such as John Stewart acknowledging that he was drunk and stoned and confused and shocked, and that he lied to the police. So while there was not that particular avenue of attack permitted, there certainly was credibility matters addressed.
What about the fact that the lawyer, trial counsel, did not raise at trial the attack on credibility? Was that prejudicial?
It wasn't
prejudicial. Assuming it's error.
Yeah. No, because if the record with regard to what the deal that John Stewart had was comes primarily from the deputy district attorney's description to the court of the circumstances, and her description stated there was no deal, that the charges against John Stewart were reduced, the plea offer was made to John Stewart on the morning of John Stewart's preliminary exam in his own case, which I believe was April 21st. She told the court, we made the offer that morning. Later in that morning, defense counsel came to us and said, my client has some information about a homicide. The offer, the agreement to which John Stewart pled was the offer that was made before his counsel ever approached the defense. So there is absolutely nothing in the record to indicate that there was a deal. What there is in the record is the deputy district attorney's assertions regarding the circumstances and denying that there was a deal. John Stewart did testify at the post-conviction hearing, so he was called, but there was nothing developed in the record at that post-conviction hearing as to what he thought the deal might have been. So there's nothing in the record to suggest that there's any prejudice from failing, from defense counsel's failing to get anything in, because there's nothing to suggest that there was anything to get in. And I guess I would note that John Stewart at the post-conviction counsel reaffirmed his story that he was telling the truth at the preliminary
hearing. Mr. Castle, how do you respond to the argument by Mr. Rose that is based on Wirtz, the argument that this is a discretionary ruling and therefore the law of the case doctrine is inapplicable?
Well, I think the distinction is the one that I think Justice Sykes drew between an appellate ruling that affirms a discretionary decision by a lower court, which simply says we conclude that the trial court acted within its discretion, not that it was the right decision or the wrong decision, but that it was acting within its discretion. When an appellate court reverses, it is saying as a matter of law that decision was wrong, and when the basis for the reversal is a question of constitutional law, a confrontation clause, that is a question of law. Some cases describe it as a question of constitutional fact, others as questions of law, but it's the same non-deferential ruling on a matter of law.
Mr. Castle, the credibility of John Stewart was essence of the issue before this court 4 years ago?
Well, the whether the inability to question him at the preliminary hearing regarding the circumstances of one of his statements to the police, which presumably was an attempt to get at credibility, whether that was an unusual circumstance was the issue before the court 4 years ago.
Did Mr. Stewart's trial counsel make the argument here?
Yes, I believe he did. Yes, it was Mr. Bramshire, I believe.
So that the inability to test the credibility of John Stewart, that argument was made here, and I assume would have been very much on the mind of trial counsel when he went back to trial.
Correct.
So that if he didn't make all the arguments that he could have made, what do we draw from that? It could have been incompetence, or it could have been strategy.
Yeah, what we know he did do on the record was he asked the court to take judicial notice of the John Stewart's criminal files, which were closed by that point. And the court said, the files alone, the jury's just going to be speculating, that's not enough. So counsel perhaps could have called John Stewart's defense counsel to inquire whether there was any deal. He didn't. And what we were to make of that he's he was ineffective, I think the answer is no, because for the reasons I explained, since there was no deal, there was no prejudice from not following up on that. I have no further comments. If there are no more questions, I will thank the court.
At the post-conviction hearing, who called John Stewart?
Defendant's then post-conviction counsel, Mr. Rose's predecessor.
What were they trying to establish through his testimony?
There was a claim that there was newly discovered evidence in the form of statements that John Stewart allegedly made once he got to prison that were supposedly recanting his preliminary hearing testimony, and that's when John Stewart reaffirmed that he was telling the truth and denied that he told people in prison that he had lied at the preliminary hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Castle. Mr. Rose.
First of all, I, on the issue of the order, and I think this is implicitly the problem, what does that reversal mean? Does it mean the appellate decision was wrong? Does it mean that this case is not at this point, shouldn't be reviewed and that we should admit the evidence and see what the outcome is? That's the problem. I don't know what the reversal meant other than reversed. I think that the real importance here of why there needs to be a reasoned decision with legal authorities, legal reasoning. Mr. Stewart was convicted of murders in prison until the year 2029, or that's when he's eligible for parole. I understand the need for speed in these instances, and certainly Mr. Stewart at the time probably felt the same way, that there needs to be some type of speedy decision so that the trial can go on. However, given that, I think the trial court disagreed with the reversal, and the Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court's decision. And I think that's very important, and it's particularly important when we're trying to determine whether or not that preliminary hearing testimony should be admitted. The trial court apparently believed that it shouldn't have been, neither did the Court of Appeals. It's our position that the trial court was correct, and as was the Court of Appeals. I think that it's important that we do have, just as when litigants come before an appellate court, we have to provide legal reasoning, legal authorities, no matter how correct the decision of the trial court may be. If we simply make a conclusory statement that the trial court was correct or incorrect or what have you, it's the Court of Appeals won't even consider it. In fact, the trial court, if you don't cite to it legal reasoning or legal authorities, many times won't even consider the argument. So when we, as a litigant, come before an appellate court or a Supreme Court, ask for a decision one way or another, whether it's a reversal or an affirmance, that decision, if it's not supported by legal authorities, legal reasoning, or an opinion, won't even be considered, no matter how correct or incorrect the decision was, depending upon what your particular position is at that time. So I think that it is important. It's important for my client. It's important for simply to, if in fact Mr. Stewart is going to say, well, what was the reason why the Supreme Court, the highest court of the state, reversed, and the only thing I can, as his attorney, tell him is, I don't know. I think he requires more, as well as does his attorney, whether it's a trial or an appellate counsel. So I think that's the reason why it's important. Secondly,
Can you give me a timeline? Here.
Yes.
Can you give me a timeline? The trial began when? What date?
I don't, let's see.
February 8th, 1999?
That sounds about right.
Okay. Then I take it that the trial judge ruled on February 11th of 1999 that this testimony was inadmissible. So then an appeal was, the trial was stayed, is that what happened?
Correct, by the appellate court.
And then on February 16th of 1999, the Court of Appeals affirmed.
Right.
And what date did we affirm the, or reverse the Court of Appeals?
February 23rd, 1999.
February 23rd?
Correct.
Did we issue a preliminary order? Because I see, at least you say here in yours, that the trial recommenced on February 17th.
Well, it recommenced, but then I believe that's when there was a stay issued.
There was what?
A stay issued of the trial.
Okay.
And at once, then nothing occurred other than to inform, I believe, the parties that there was a stay issue.
He entered a stay on February 19th. I'm looking at Appendix 102.
Okay.
Right.
So they ruled the 16th. We granted the emergency petition and granted the stay on February 19th.
And then what date was our decision?
February 23.
February 23. Thank you. And when was the oral argument held in this court?
That I'm uncertain of.
Sometime between the 19th and 23rd.
And to be. I'm just wondering if, you know, we heard oral argument and gave the decision the same day, or.
Yeah, I'm uncertain as to that fact. Secondly, I see my time is up here, but just.
Conclude rapidly,
sure.
Please.
Briefly, regarding this deal that the Deputy District Attorney stated that no deal existed. Well, that clearly isn't the case, and in fact, he said that at post-conviction hearing, that well, I think what the state said, that there wasn't any evidence in the record that a deal existed, and in fact, a deal did exist, and that was, in fact, the reason for the post-conviction hearing, and there were a number of exhibits attached. Whether or not John Stewart actually got to testify to that, I don't believe he did. But it's our position that there was a deal that, in fact, existed. So,
Chief, if I may, one quick question about Bradley. Thank you.
Yes.
One quick question about the record. Were briefs filed in this court?
For the interlocutory?
It's
Briefs were filed, but I don't believe that the trial counsel filed a brief. I think only the state did, if I recall correctly. That's my.
Check that
I think
too.
So. Thank you.
Pretty short time between the 16th and 23rd. Justice Babbage?
Well, Attorney Castle indicates that he has copies of the briefs filed.
In the prior case.
We make copies of those and make them available.
You may. Do you have any objection to that, Mr. Rose? Okay. If you mind giving it to the marshal, we'll make copies, a copy now and later, additional copies, so that we don't have to go to the library and pick it up, if that's all right with you. Is that all right with you?
Yes.
And make a copy for Mr. Rose, right?
Thank you.
Okay.
Your Honor, I have three documents. I have the state's brief and appendix. I have the defendant's brief and appendix, and the state also filed a separate appendix.
And what dates were those?
They were filed simultaneously. The only one with the date stamp is the defendant's, which is February 22, 1999, but it's my recollection that it was simultaneous briefing.
And the date of oral argument, do you have that, Mr.
I don't remember offhand whether it was the 22nd or the 23rd.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. That concludes our hearing in 01-1345-CR, State v. Stewart. And the court will take a moment's recess so that our students who are leaving may leave and students who are coming in may come in. So we're in a few moments of recess.
Hello.
I'm Angela.
Oh, hi. Oh, you have the brief. Okay. Yes. Hi. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Were those the ones that were filed at the time of the interlocutory thing?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Some reason I thought the defendant didn't, but I don't remember. I never had these in my possession. I didn't see them. Okay.
It was all filed same day.
Oh, okay.
Either argued later that day or the next morning.
Yeah, okay.
Where do we get
copies of that from?
Through the
to the marshal. And I assume I'll get these back, and if you need them, I'll be happy to send you them. So.
Yeah, that's fine. Thanks.
Hell, I filed paragraphs internally. What?